Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Our Bodies, Our Stories. Today, we're going to be talking about abortion in a post-Roe world. It's been almost a year since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, leaving millions of people in around 24 states with a total or near total abortion ban. However, we could talk about all of the facts and implications of this, but we don't want to bog you down with a ton of information. So now we are going to interview Dr. Johnson here at Tulane to get her take about society in a post-Roe world. Dr. Johnson is the director of Gender and Sexuality Studies program here at Tulane, my major advisor and my current sociology professor. All right, so first, what were you doing when you found out about the overturn of Roe v. Wade, and were you surprised?
So I was trying to think back what I was doing at the time, and I don't exactly remember, but I know that I probably found out, of course, hearing the leaked draft opinion early, like many people did, because I recall reading about that, probably on my BBC News app on my phone, and of course talking about it with other faculty on campus who are in a reproductive justice working group. So people, faculty with similar research interests around reproductive justice who get together. So we definitely were talking about that. The second part of your question was I surprised? Unfortunately, no. And was I disappointed? Absolutely. Feeling kind of just deflated, feeling kind of like, is this really where we're at? Right. But a lot of people who work on reproductive issues really saw this coming for a long time, and just hoped it wouldn't eventually get to this point. We saw a lot of chipping away almost immediately after the Roe decision. So we had a lot of things that were happening in the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, different court decisions that really eroded some of the terms of Roe. And I was actually looking back because I published an article in 2014 that was looking at state-mandated counseling materials for abortion. And in the intro of that article, I cited something from Guttmacher Institute that said that 2011 was a record year for state restrictions on abortion. So, like, this was something that we really saw coming over time. Yeah, definitely not surprised.
Yeah, it's still sort of kind of scary that when it would happen, because I didn't know any of that. I was sort of like in my little bubble. I was like, yay, we have Roe v. Wade. And then I remember when the early draft like came out, I just remember like frantically texting my older sister and being like, did you just see what happened? And then I was actually with her when Roe fell. And then we both just kind of looked at each other. We were like, oh, like, did
Yeah.
this really just happen? Launched us back like 50 years. So it was,
Absolutely.
yeah.
Absolutely. And that was definitely the feeling, like, what just happened? Like, what are we doing now, right? And what is this going to look like? So, yeah, for sure.
It felt like a punch in the face, just kind of like, oh, you thought you had any sort of reproductive rights? No.
Yeah.
Especially because, like, I'm from Texas, so it was an immediate sort of like ban on abortion. And it actually only took in Texas 6 hours after the abortion ban was put in place for a hospital to see their first like self-induced abortion related death. It's, it was awful.
And that's part of the fallout, which I think, we're going to talk about in a little bit. But that's part of the reality of this, so.
And so, what do you think about the reproductive health care access in New Orleans, specifically at like Tulane or Loyola?
So, I mean, we can, I think we kind of have to think about New Orleans separate from Tulane and Loyola, or because we've got the New Orleans community, which of course has a lot more racial and socioeconomic diversity, and therefore a lot more health outcome and healthcare related inequalities. So I think when we're talking about the picture in New Orleans more generally, There's a lot of uneven and unequal access that people in the community have. When we're talking about Tulane and Loyola, you know, there's also some differences there, because Loyola is a religious institution, Jesuit institution specifically. And so my best guess, without knowing too much of the ins and outs of Loyola, is that Tulane students probably have somewhat easier and better access to reproductive health care. I do also know that in terms of, and of course we have to think about reproductive health care broadly, but also then, you know, access to abortion care specifically. So of course it's non-existent for everybody here, right? Mm-hmm. But thinking about things like contraceptive access and emergency contraception and safer sex supplies, I know that there are certain groups and agencies on Tulane's campus that have really tried to work to create, there's kind of these little drop zones that we see throughout campus, especially in the residence halls. There is an affiliate group. It's not technically a student organization, but it's called Big Easy EC, right? And so it was started by a Tulane student several years ago, and they do a 24-hour delivery service of emergency contraception to both Tulane and Loyola students. And I believe actually as a result of that initiative back in 2019, it really prompted the Tulane Student Health Center to start offering free emergency contraception. And so both Tulane and Loyola students can get free emergency contraception from Tulane Student Health Center. So Loyola students can come over and get some of that here. We also know that, you know, the university students at Tulane and Loyola, especially at Tulane, come from more privileged backgrounds on average. They're more likely to be from out of state, and they're probably more likely to be from states where they'll still have more comprehensive access to reproductive health care. So even if they can't get it here, they still have some way of maybe flying back home for healthcare and getting access to it that way. But, you know, people who live in New Orleans who are here are going to have that really uneven access because they're more place dependent on getting their healthcare. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's a pretty uneven picture of access, I would say, right?
Yeah, especially because Tulane is able to do so much for its students. I feel like in particular, you know, like I've never had to worry about that. And, you know, even at like the healthcare center, if you want to get on birth control, you can go and do that, you know? So Tulane is also sort of available to Loyola students, but I would agree that in the New Orleans area, it's a completely different story.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and again, a lot of that's going to be based on someone's kind of individual resource situation. Like, can they travel? Can they take off work? Do they have the funds and the means to do so?
Yeah, that was one thing my co-host Sina and I talked about in a previous episode, is just how like abortion bans end up disproportionately affecting marginalized groups in a lot of different ways, and particularly poorer groups, because when someone has the financial means to go and travel to states where abortion is protected, like California, Colorado, you know, they have that ability to go take a vacation, and they can also take off work to recover from the medical procedure. Mm-hmm. But when people don't have that financial ability, it's disproportionate, like I said. If you could make one change to improve the reproductive healthcare system, what would it be?
Yeah, so, you know, these are hard questions to think about, to answer, right? What's the one thing? And so I think part of my response when I think about these questions is to think that, you know, there's not one change that we can make that will actually improve stuff. So thinking about a reproductive justice framework, one of the things that encourages us is to actually see how everything is really interconnected, right? as opposed to we have, you know, particular discrete reproductive issues. And that reproductive issues are interwoven with social justice and human rights issues more broadly. So there's not this like silver bullet solution. So like, yay, great.
Yeah.
But I also have really been a proponent of what's called the small wins approach to thinking about these bigger problems. So I do think that, you know, we can, even if we're not going to address the whole problem, we can kind of make small changes or small movements toward progress, hopefully. That being said, I was struggling with this, with that one change. And I kept thinking, you know, so many of the draconian laws that we're seeing lately, like abortion bans, denying gender affirming care, I really, really keep coming back to this idea that it's groups of people in power to make these decisions who are really lacking in empathy, and really able to deny this really basic humanity to certain groups of people, right? And so I don't know if the answer is we need to cultivate more empathy, but I really see that as part of the root of the problem, you know, in terms of like how we need to create change. So I don't know how we turn that into like system level change, but I see that connection here with a lot of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like not realizing, or maybe we are realizing it and not caring that we're putting something into place that's going to dramatically affect some real person's life, you know, to such a negative point. So, yeah.
No, yeah, and that it is a kind of a hard question. Just like target one thing, because you know you could say like, I want to undo the abortion ban, but then they could put bans on birth control or like access to even basic health care. I remember at one point there was talks about in Texas about some lawmaker was trying to introduce a bill that was going to pregnancy test women or like just anyone with a uterus, like as they were leaving the state to make sure that someone wasn't going to get an abortion, which is
right.
Ridiculous.
And who benefits from that, right? That's the question. Like, how is this improving our society, our communities, right? Who benefits from that? I think nobody, right? So, yeah.
I mean, the bill didn't get passed, but it's also the fact that it was even introduced in the first place, it's kind of like, it's so ridiculous and so extreme.
Mm-hmm.
That it's like, well, maybe I want to get rid of like these lawmakers. Reproductive healthcare access is just so big and encompassing. You know, even just like include like getting better birth control access, because once again, in Texas, I'm very well versed in like the Texas politics of this, but there was recently a law that was passed saying that minors can't get on birth control without parental consent.
Right. Yeah.
And so that also opens up an entire new world of problems for, say, someone that is maybe 15, has really painful periods, needs to get on birth control to help that. And then they can't do that because maybe their parents don't like birth control, don't believe in it, they had a bad experience with themselves, you know.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things, all kinds of issues that I think really need some careful thought. And I, you know, we can't just rely on policymakers to be making these decisions. They really need to be informed by our philosophers and our bioethics people and our social scientists, right? Because there are a lot of people who are thinking through, like, what are the implications of all these? What are the pros and cons? How can we look at this ethically? Like, should a minor be able to do this or not? Well, it's not just a yes, no issue, right? It's like, well, under what conditions would we think a minor should be able to do this? What are the implications, right? And I don't feel like those discussions are meaningfully happening. Or are able to happen, right? With a lot of these laws that are being either proposed or implemented.
Okay. So how do you see, sort of circling back to what we were talking about earlier, how do you see the long-term impact of the overturn of Roe v. Wade and how this affects marginalized groups in particular?
Yeah, I mean, long-term impacts, like people's lives are going to be dramatically impacted. People are going to have unintended pregnancies. They're going to have unwanted pregnancies. We will have desperate people who are seeking to terminate their pregnancies in unsafe and extra legal conditions. Because when we make people desperate, they you know, try to do things to make their lives better. Anyone who can get pregnant will be bearing the brunt of this. They're going to have disruptions to their jobs, disruptions to their educational opportunities. They'll have more likelihood of economic hardship. They're just going to have a more general inability to exercise a certain degree of control over their reproductive lives, right? So these are kind of major implications in terms of how it's going to affect people in general who can get pregnant or the partners of those people. But also when we think about inequalities, of course, marginalized people who have fewer resources, fewer access, you know, to social support, fewer, more limited access to healthcare, right? Of course, they're going to be bearing the brunt of this more so than other people. So as a sociologist, I always try to bring in my sociological thinking. So we've got a theoretical perspective in sociology called cumulative inequality. And so the basic idea here is that disadvantage or advantage accumulates over the life course, right? So people are set up to begin with at unequal kind of starting positions. But as they move throughout their life course, things become even more unequal, because if somebody's in a disadvantaged position, you know, they're not going to all of a sudden, you know, keep up with people who started out in a better position. And so, of course, this is going to really unequally impact people who were disadvantaged to begin with, right? So it's just going to make things, it's going to make things worse, and it's going to impact all these different dimensions of people's lives. So.
Yeah, and it's just, it's such a, like a compounding effect as well, when it's like when someone maybe is born in a household that has generations in there, or they're just poor in general and don't have as much financial mobility. And then maybe then because of rampant gerrymandering, they don't get into the next school that might be better funded. It's so like,
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of people don't, they fail to grasp that concept.
Yeah, absolutely. It's this idea that being poor costs people more, right? You know, even the simple example of, oh, you get a parking ticket and then you can't pay it in time, and then there's late fees and you didn't have the money to pay for the parking ticket to begin with, and so now you have to pay the parking ticket on top of the late fees, and that just starts to accumulate. And whereas the person who could easily pay for the parking ticket ends up paying less, right? Because they're just going to pay for the parking ticket and not all the late fees, right? So yeah, it's poverty costs people, right? Yeah.
And it's almost like it's just a punishment, especially with abortion bans coming in. It's a punishment for...
Right, for being poor or being a person with a uterus and saying, you can no longer make these really important decisions about your body, your health, and your life, you know? Yeah, yeah.
It makes you so sad. I don't remember where it was, but I saw something, and it was like people would have to prove that they had been raped or that it was a result of incest before they could actually go and get the abortion. Like they were going to have to prove it.
Yeah,
maybe it was in Florida.
Yeah, that does sound familiar, but I can't recall off the top of my head. And of course, given, you know, all the other laws that have been passed or proposed are related to abortion access, that definitely sounds in that vein. So yeah, it's unfortunate.
It's awful. Makes me so sad.
Yeah.
And then sort of moving on to our final question. A study showed that banning abortion today will lead to a 21% increase in pregnancy-related deaths. And another study showed that banning abortion will increase crime rates over the next few years. So you, Dr. Johnson, as a sociology professor, how do you see this creating new social problems in the future? And maybe how that connects to the Turnaway study that was done and is very popular.
Yeah, so you've got a couple things in here. Yeah, so we definitely know. So there has been some really excellent research that shows us pretty definitively that legal abortion care is safer than childbirth, especially in the United States, right? So there was a 2012 study. I think it was published in Obstetrics and Gynecology. And it was really looking at mortality rates in either as a result of abortion or giving birth across a number of years and a number of data sets, right? So they're pulling all this together. So I was looking back at some of the stats here. So for childbirth, on average, there were 8.8 people who died for every 100,000 live births. And for abortion, it was 0.6 people who died for 100,000 abortion. Okay. So abortion is much safer than giving birth in the US. So it would not be surprising to see that we're going to have a substantial increase in pregnancy-related deaths as a result of this, right? So part of this is because in the U.S., we also have some of the worst maternal mortality outcomes in the Western industrialized world. We are, I believe, leading in that, and that's not something that we want to be leading in, right? And actually, I believe there was some 2021 data that showed that rates were only getting worse for maternal mortality, right? So giving birth in the U.S. is not safe, right? So that's a huge thing that we'll have to contend with. So you asked about the abortion and crime study. Yeah, so there was an earlier study, I think it was in the 1990s, and this is really an update on that one. I didn't realize there was an update on it, but the early study was really controversial because the premise was basically abortion helps people deal with unwanted children. And if we make sure that they're never born, they won't be able to commit crimes because, of course, all unwanted children will turn into juvenile delinquents and then criminals, right? Well, there's some issues with thinking about that connection and that, you know, that cause and effect. So I don't think we should think about abortion as a crime prevention tool. I think we need to think about abortion as necessary healthcare. And so, you know, that study, and I'm guessing the newer iteration of it will probably get a lot of media attention. But I don't know that we should be putting a whole lot of stock in that study in particular. I think we should focus more on the health implications, right? And the maternal mortality implications and economic hardship and, you know, basic autonomy, right? So, you know, you said, okay, how is this creating new social problems in the future? I mean, the biggest social problem, which I think we've already, you know, we've kind of been talking about this whole time, is just the erosion of rights, right? Yeah. And this like reassertion that women and people who can get pregnant are really second class citizens, okay? But they don't have full control over their bodies, over their lives. And this is not a new social problem. It's an old social problem, rearing its ugly head again, yet again, right? So we really, you can look back to a lot of the kind of second wave feminist scholarship and, you know, the history books and looking at this and thinking about, okay, well, what was happening before Roe was, you know, put in place as a Supreme Court decision. And I think that's where we can go to say, what can we expect? Well, that's probably what we can expect. We can expect that people are going to die from extra legal, unsafe abortion. We can expect that there's going to be a lot of job and educational disruption that is going to unfairly burden women, people of color, poor people, that there might be a lot of, times where people are just sort of figuring out how to meet their needs for basic survival because of this, right? So I think that's where we can go to understand what the implications of this are going to be long term, because we've unfortunately been in this position before. So
It's just sort of like, as you're talking about, like, the old social problems, I also think it kind of just stems from this idea of, like, the man or as like the ideal citizen or, like, the default citizen. And then, you know, any other gender just sort of kind of is, like, an other. But this is the default, and then, other.
I mean, you know, that we, it's a statement of fact that we have some people existing in our society who have many more rights and ability to make decisions about their lives than other people do, and that's something that we can't and shouldn't stand for. So
And especially with the difference in physical accountability, you know, for the person that has the uterus and is going to be, like, carrying the fetus, it's a totally different story when someone else who might have, like, done the impregnation that, like, has the penis, there's no, like, same physical accountability, you know? Yeah. It feels like the definition of, like, sexism when their physical accountability is so different. It puts all the burden on the person with the uterus.
Yeah, it puts all the burden on that. There's also there's a lot of people who come back and say, well, there's always adoption. It's like, well, first of all, we're talking about a pregnancy that lasts 9 months, and pregnancy itself is not guaranteed to be safe or healthy for everybody. It requires a certain foundation of nutritious food, access to health care, right, the ability to kind of go through that. So adoption is not a solution here. This is not a solution, right?
I mean, I was gonna say, just adoption is a solution to not being a parent, but not a solution to not wanting to be pregnant.
Exactly. And thank you. Yeah.
It doesn't help when it's like, oh, well, you still need to go through these 9 months. And especially when there's so many changes that can happen to the pregnant person's body and their mental state. Particularly, like, you know, sometimes a lot of people will be pregnant and then they end up wanting to keep the baby that is born because they just spent 9 months carrying it, you know, and so then they just became a parent when they didn't want to or didn't have the financial means to be, and it's awful.
So these are not, you know, equivalent solutions, right? It's there are two different things. You're absolutely right. It's being pregnant versus not being pregnant, being able to decide when and how and where to become pregnant, right? Versus the decision to parent, right? Those are two completely separate decisions. So
well, is there anything else that you sort of wanted to talk about today, or just like
I think one of the lingering questions for a lot of people is, now that we've seen the undoing of Roe, what's next, right? Because a lot of these decisions are really sort of interconnected in the logic that they're using. And so there's definitely a fear about losing access to contraception, losing access to you know, emergency contraception, and of course, dismantling things like same-sex marriage, maybe even interracial marriage, right? Which was only decided a few years before before Roe, right? So all these things that are really about intimacy, privacy, and you know, family, that we're all sort of interconnected. So I think that's definitely the fear on the horizon. What could be next? So
yeah, hopefully it's none of those things.
Right.
A girl can dream.
Yeah.
One of my friends is in an interracial same-sex marriage, and I just remember one time she was like, dang, they really came for us in two different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So,
thank you so much for joining me. And to all of our listeners, make sure to subscribe to our podcast, and we shall see you next time.